This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This week, the Charlotte School of Law opened for the spring semester. They are working to regain their footing after the school took some severe body blows last year, first from the American Bar Association, which put them on probation over their admissions policy, then the federal government refusing to continue funding student loans for those attending the school. And just prior to the start of the spring semester, the state's largest law school laid off two-thirds of its faculty. Yesterday, the Charlotte Observer described the school as stripped down, tottering. But why? How did this for-profit institution find itself in this predicament? Were they spending too much time looking at the bottom line? Was greed a motive in admitting students the ABA alleges had no chance of passing the bar? Or were other factors at work? Other law schools are facing shrinking enrollments because students don't want to rack up a mountain of debt to enter an industry that may not need them. And the biggest question of all, can they survive this storm and what happens to all those students who can no longer get student loans? We have several experts with us this hour, including a former Charlotte School of Law teacher, a current student, and an expert on transparency. We also asked for someone from Charlotte School of Law to be on the program to represent their point of view. They sent us a note saying, unfortunately, we will not participate in Charlotte Talks because the subject of the program is the subject of pending litigation. We strongly disagree with the allegations in that litigation, and we will address them in the proper forum. As such, we have no further comment at this time. So let me begin this hour with Lisa Wharf, who has been reporting on this for WFAE News, where she is also assistant news director. Good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning.
This is, or was, the largest law school in the state. Based on what? Enrollment?
Based on enrollment, for sure. Back a few years ago, it had nearly 1,500 students. This was back in 2013. So it was easily the largest law school. And it's trimmed down this year quite a bit, I think around 800 students. And of course, now, because they don't have any federal loan money coming to it, it's much, much less, though I don't know how much less.
We're going to explore each of these things that came to light over the course of the last several months, at least it came to light to the public. I'm just curious about when you think, or when we know, maybe we know, the Charlotte School of Law became aware that they had a problem. Was it when the ABA talked to them in November last year, which was then compounded in December by the federal government withdrawing student loan funds? Or was it well in advance of all of that?
Well, the ABA notified them already in January of 2015 that it appeared to them they were not demonstrating compliance with their ABA standards. And
but did that come as a surprise to them, or do we know?
I think they knew that their review was coming up, and for sure their bar passage rate was low. You know, it wasn't always low, but it got pretty low. And students that it was accepting, the LSAT scores were quite low. So I imagine that they saw it coming. Back in 2013, WFAE's Julie Rose at the time, she reported a story about, you know, looking at their job placement rates and that it was, you know, pretty low job placement rates afterwards.
The ABA came to the conclusion that the Charlotte School of Law was admitting people who weren't qualified to get in, who most likely could not pass the bar at the end of their studies. How did they reach that conclusion? Just by looking at the track record of students going through the process?
Well, you look at the entrance and the exit. So for, you know, the ABA discloses all these, you know, the LSAT scores of entering students, and they did get lower over the years and to a point that was quite low for a school. And then you look at the other side of things and how many students who are graduating are able to pass the bar in their first try. And, you know, that got to be in the 40 range.
So the ABA put the school on probation last November. For how long? And are they still in that probationary period?
They are still on probation. So,
And what do they have to do during this period to have that probation removed?
Well, the ABA brought up several concerns that they had. So, you know, and among that was admissions. Among that was bar passage rate. And so, I mean, you know, part of this is responding to those criticisms of the school. But at this rate, yeah, they're on probation, and that's a first
So that was the first of a 1-2 punch. In December, the federal government, I think the Department of Education, said they would no longer fund student loans to students attending the Charlotte School of Law. What led to that decision? And that's the Obama administration, and we'll be talking about what may happen under the Trump administration in a moment. But when did they? Why did they reach that decision?
Well, a lot of that was based on the ABA probation. But furthermore, they said, hey, the school was not letting students know about its rocky accreditation status with the ABA. So that was a large part of the federal government's complaint with why they pulled those federal loans.
So they're supposed to tell incoming students we're in trouble, we're not a very good school, we have a terrible track record, you're liable not to get a job, you're liable not to pass the bar, we're letting you in, but you're not supposed to be here. Is that what they're supposed to do?
They said that you on your website shouldn't say you're fully accredited by the ABA, which the school argues, well, we still were fully accredited, mm-hmm. although it was on probationary status. And then
Did they mention that on their website, that they were on probationary status? Because if you go to their website right now, they do have tabs that talk about the situation.
Yes. It takes about 3 or 4 clicks to get through those tabs. And once you click on that information, I mean, that link is not so clear what it is. But that was one of the reasons that students had no clue that the ABA was so closely scrutinizing them over the past 2 years.
In its final months, the Obama administration allegedly became more aggressive in its approach to for-profit educational institutions, of which the Charlotte School of Law is. Is that connected to this, the fact that they were just going to go after these for-profit organizations? And might that change under a more business-friendly Trump administration, particularly with a president who had his own schools at one point?
I think part of what happened with probationary status was also pressure that the ABA felt to really make some changes about how law schools were treating admissions and bar passage. So that was part of it. But yes, I mean, the school, Charlotte School of Law, is now pinning their hopes on a new administration, thinking that maybe they'll be more friendly to them in this situation.
So let me bring Kyle McEntee into this conversation. He is executive director and he doesn't care if I say co-founder, but I've already said it. Executive director of Law School Transparency, which was founded in 2009 to help prospective law students make informed decisions and to make legal education affordable. And he joins us, I believe, from WUNC in Chapel Hill. Welcome, Kyle.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So if the Obama administration was cracking down on for-profit schools, that must mean that this problem is more widespread than just the Charlotte School of Law. And you co-founded your organization, Law School Transparency, in 2009. Was that part of the reason? Is this going on all over the place?
We founded the organization in response to a slightly different problem. At the time, law schools were providing misleading and fraudulent employment statistics to prospective students in the public. And once we uncovered that, we decided that that was unacceptable and that that needed to change.
So essentially what you started your organization was because law schools were painting a rosier picture of post-law school employment opportunities than actually exist in the real world, correct?
Exactly. And that inflated the demand for law school. And so once the truth came out, demand fell precipitously and quickly.
Some say that Charlotte School of Law is the first accredited law school to ever lose its federal aid dollars. Does that say more about the school and its practices or more about the Obama administration becoming more aggressive?
I think it says a lot about both. The business practices at law schools have evolved greatly over the last decade, and it came at the right time with an administration that was actually interested and holding schools accountable for their use of taxpayer dollars.
Is the administration of Charlotte School of Law or any of these for-profit schools, are they attorneys or are they business people who simply started this as a business opportunity, Lisa?
The administration of Charlotte School of Law, yes, they are attorneys by and large. But the administration of InfoLaw, which is the company that operates all these for-profit schools, they are not run by attorneys.
So are there ethical violations going on here that we know about, or can we say that? Would that be accurate to say that there are ethical violations if these allegations are proven to be true that could get the administrators in trouble as attorneys with the bar? I guess maybe, Kyle, you're best set up to answer that question.
Perhaps. It really depends on the state in which they're licensed, and I'm not familiar enough with the ethics regulations in Florida, which is where a lot of the InfoLaw attorneys are, and nor am I in North Carolina, okay. So InfoLaw, I'm not too equipped.
InfoLaw is the company that owns Charlotte School of Law and a school, I believe, in Arizona and a school in Florida. Charlotte School of Law's enrollment is way down for this spring semester. Is that simply because of the tsunami of bad news, or was it in decline even before that? Who knows the answer to that question?
Well, right now, it dropped off precipitously. I don't know how much, but because of the federal loans, too. I mean, the school was getting $48 million in federal loans, which is a huge amount. So when you say to students, you can no longer receive this, you know, students are going to second guess what's going on. And now the school has said, we're still hoping that we can get that loan money restored. So at this point, we'll just credit your accounts for the tuition and expect that to be coming in. But sure, I mean, it has a lot of students scared.
So you started your organization, Kyle, because you saw law schools painting a rosier picture of employment than reality would support. Were they painting that same picture at Charlotte School of Law? Is that part? I know that's not part of the ABA's problem with them, nor is it part of the Education Department's problem with them. But is that something they were engaged in?
Absolutely. Every law school in the country was engaged in this. And the extent of the lie varied based on the quality of the school. But Charlotte, at Charlotte, only about a third of graduates end up getting real law jobs. And so they were advertising rates 70, 80, 90% for years.
Is the reason they're not getting as many law studies? I think it's a third of the graduates get law jobs. Is that because there simply aren't enough jobs out there? Or is that because the students are not educated well enough for law firms to hire them? Is there a stigma against the school by law firms that predates their current problems?
Yeah, I'm not sure it has to do with the education or the perceived education. I think it has more to do with the stigma of a for-profit school, of a school that also has a reputation as a diploma mill. And North Carolina has a lot of law schools. And law school enrollment in North Carolina continued to increase after the recession, despite information that showed that shouldn't have been happening.
You say that this was all about continuing to make money, and you say that the company that owns this school, InfoLaw, has been exploiting students. That's your word. You say they knew they were letting unqualified students in, students who would have no chance of passing the bar, students who were accumulating student debt that they would, in all likelihood, be unable to repay through a law career, and they kept doing it because they wanted the money. How do you know that?
Well, the school is dependent on tuition dollars, and their tuition dollars come from taxpayer money through student loans. 90% of their revenue comes from student loans. And so if all of your revenue comes from that same place, you got to figure out how to keep that spigot going.
Kyle McEntee is Executive Director of Law School Transparency. He's with us. Lisa Worf is also here from WFAE News. She's been reporting on this, and we'll bring in two other folks as well, including a student of Charlotte School of Law, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony, presenting Second City Guide to the Symphony, the troupe that launched the careers of John Belushi and Stephen Colbert, celebrating the symphony with comedy and music, February 4th at Belk Theater, info@charlottesymphony.org. And the Assistance League of Charlotte, hosting a prospective member tour on Saturday at 10 a.m., discussing how you can clothe, feed, mentor, and educate children in the Charlotte area. More information at charlotteassistanceleague.org. The Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, is on the chopping block. Republicans have promised to repeal and replace it, though no one seems to know with what. Still, changes are definitely coming, and they will likely impact the whole healthcare industry. Republicans say insurance out of the ACA is too expensive, but those who have it use it. If that stops, what will the impact be, and what other changes might we expect? We talk about that on this program with some experts willing to share their thoughts tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point in our 100-day spotlight, President Trump says he'll cut regulation by 75%, maybe more. What would deregulation on that scale mean for the economy, for workers, for the environment? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the fate of the Charlotte School of Law and how it got itself into the pickle it finds itself in today with Lisa Wharf from WFAE News, who has been reporting on this and has filed some extensive reports, part of which we'll hear on this program in a moment, but you can also hear on our website at WFAE.org. We're also joined by Kyle McEntee, Executive Director of Law School Transparency, and we will be also speaking to two other folks in a moment. Unfortunately, we were not able to encourage people from Charlotte School of Law to join us, but we did extend the invitation, and they issued a statement to. They sent us an email saying that they couldn't be here because our topic is the subject of pending litigation, with which they strongly disagree, and they will address those allegations in the proper forum, and as such, they have no further comment at this time. So we did extend that invitation to them. There have been articles for several years in major publications like the New York Times about the difficulty of law school graduates of all stripes finding employment. A smart person might see this, and one would think that people going for a law degree are smart, but a smart person might see this and decide not to run up a ton of debt on a law school education. They may have decided not to enter law school. Is that what was happening to a degree at Charlotte School of Law, Lisa? Were people staying away because they saw the employment picture and thought, maybe I better go study music?
Were they staying away?
Yes.
I think that Charlotte School of Law had difficulties that a whole lot of law schools have been facing recently, right? That there's declining, fewer applications coming in for law schools. And so right at the top law schools, you're still getting really strong applications, but everywhere LSAT scores are dipping for those who are admitted to law schools. And for Charlotte School of Law, that was certainly the case.
And if you're for-profit, Kyle, that really does ramp up the need to find other ways to get people into the door, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, especially when you are ruthless and greedy.
Those are your words.
They are.
Ruthless and greedy, and you said that they were exploiting students. Do you feel that those words are too strong, or do you feel fairly certain that those are good words to use in describing them?
I've been following this school for years now, and I really don't think they're too strong. If anything, you know, the laughter understates the genuine belief behind them.
Brian Clark is an assistant professor of business law at Western Carolina University and a former Charlotte School of Law professor. He joins us now by phone. Brian, would you use similar words to describe them?
I don't know. It's certainly from, it could certainly look that way. You know, ruthless, that one I'm not quite sure about. You know, greedy. Certainly, I think that the profit motive, the for-profit model, and Infolaw's need to return, for return on investment to its investors, certainly motivated a lot of the decisions that were being made. And so I think greedy might be more than fair. Ruthless, I don't know. I think maybe that's a little more of Kyle's opinion, but. Certainly, some things that were done that were not right. And, the Department of Education put a big bad word on it, fraud. which is pretty harsh.
If the ABA's reason for putting them on probation, that they were admitting students who weren't qualified to be there and pushing unqualified graduates toward a bar exam that they were not going to pass, if that is true, was it true from the very beginning, from your experience, Brian, as a teacher there, or was this true only after the recession?
It absolutely was not true at the beginning. When Charlotte School of Law started, and I joined the faculty in 2011, so the year that it obtained full accreditation from the ABA. But when it started, I mean, its classes were small. They were, folks generally speaking that had, ties to Charlotte, whether they were already here or they were, just wanted to be in Charlotte. And, I think at the beginning, it was a very different environment. It was, sort of the indicators were very different. But then it grew explosively, mm-hmm. and when when there became a need to get a lot more, or a desire to get a lot more students in the seats, in an environment of declining applications, you inherently you have to admit people with a lot lower indicators.
What does it mean, a lot lower indicators? What does it mean that they were admitting students who weren't qualified and most likely would not be able to pass the bar after spending time at that school? What does it mean? Does it mean they couldn't read or write? What does it mean?
It means primarily what law schools focus on when they're determining whether someone is qualified is their undergraduate grade point average, and then their score on the law school admissions test, the LSAT. And, there is certainly some correlation. David Fracht, who's a former law professor, a former dean candidate at a info law school at Florida Coastal in Jacksonville, has done a good bit of research on correlations between LSAT score and the ability to pass the bar. The lower your LSAT score, the less likely you are to pass the bar.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but for a layperson who's never taken the LSAT, and for all of our listeners who have never taken the LSAT, what does that demonstrate? You're going to law school to learn the law. So what do you know before you go to that school and you take that LSAT? What is that LSAT testing for?
It tests for three things. There's one section of reading comprehension, so reading, a couple of paragraphs, and then answering questions about what was, what it means. Mm-hmm. There's a section on logical reasoning and two sections on analytical reasoning. And, all three of those broad skills, reading comprehension, analytical reasoning, and logical reasoning, are all critical to success in law school and as a lawyer.
At what point were you and other instructors becoming aware that your students were most likely not going to be able to pass the bar once they finished your classes?
Well, there was never a time where that blanket statement would apply, where, I never felt like none of the people in my classes would be successful. Charlotte had never hidden the ball that it was what, a lot of folks call what it calls itself, a school of opportunity. Mm-hmm. That if you don't have great indicators, great LSAT, a great GPA from your undergrad school, we're willing to give you a chance. It was always a wide variety of sort of abilities, level of preparation, those kinds of things. The percentage of folks that I was very concerned about, probably in 2013, around then, is when I started to get concerned that there were an increasing number of folks that I was seriously concerned about whether they could be successful.
Kyle McEntee, you've written that the school's first-time bar passage rate was 46.3%. That was in 2015. How does that compare to other schools?
It's significantly lower. Bar passage rates have fallen across the country, but Charlotte's are still near the bottom.
Mm-hmm. And this is where, Lisa, it starts to get worse, because you reported a week or so ago that the school at one point paid students, or gave them an incentive, a stipend, whatever you want to call it, not to take the bar, to wait. How much did they pay them and why?
Well, it sounds like that's still a practice from what I hear.
Only there at that school or in all the InfoLaw schools or in other law schools around the country?
Those allegations have come up at other InfoLaw schools like Arizona Summit. So back in 2015, they offered students a living stipend, what they called a living stipend of $11,200 to basically delay taking the bar and enter this intensive bar preparation program. So, you know, in the most generous light, you say, hey, you know, they want to give these students a stipend and really make sure they're up to speed for the bar. In the most skeptical light, you're saying, hey, you know, maybe they're trying to manipulate their bar passage numbers. And so, I mean,
did it work? Did students take advantage of it? And if they did their bar passage rate go up?
Students did take advantage of it. I think it was maybe, you know, 20 or so, a dozen or 20 at a time, it sounds like. And, you know, from what a senior administrator there said, if that's true, it sounds like it did work as far as boosting their bar passage rate a significant amount. This is a recording from a meeting with bar passage prep coaches. So this is Odessa Elm. She's the director, assistant dean of academic success. Uh-huh. And this is what she said about that.
You know, if we didn't have the extended program last time and we all didn't work really hard to defer the 21 people that we deferred, our pass rate would have likely been 20-something percent.
So, I mean, it shows that at least that is very, she's very conscious of how that program paid off for the school's bar passage rate.
You filed a very long report this morning that we've aired several times, and it's available at WFAE.org with more of that recording. Where did that come from?
That came from a law school professor who taped these meetings in 2015.
Okay.
And so she did not know she was being recorded.
And she was really, I don't know how to describe the conversation. Would you call it a pep talk? Would you call it a hit the teachers over the head with a big stick to make them perform better talk? What would you call it?
I would call it a very hardcore version of a pep talk. So this was a week, this particular meeting was a week or so before the July 2015 administration of the bar. And, you know, the school has metrics of how their students are doing, you know, through a series of, you know, mini exams and things like that. And it was clear that it wasn't looking good for these recent graduates. And so she was trying to goad the bar coaches to get on them. And so this is what she said.
When you're coaching someone and they're being lazy, do you allow them to be?
No.
Okay. So, you know, do we tell them if, you know, they're training for some event, do we just say, oh, it's okay, you're not where you need to be. Keep trying! We're not cheerleaders, we're coaches. Get down on the f***ing floor and give me 40. You're going to run more laps. Go! That's what we do. That's what a coach is. A coach is not a cheerleader.
Pretty intense.
And I know that one of the people that you talked to felt very uncomfortable during that conversation. Was he uncomfortable because of the pressure being applied? Was he uncomfortable because of the language being used? Was he uncomfortable because of the approach that she was taking to make this happen?
Yes, that was so.
All
that,
of the above.
So yeah, sort of all the above. That was at the time law school professor Andrew McAdams, mm-hmm. who said that you know, indeed. You know, he was at those meetings.
Brian,
that was the tenor, and it made him uncomfortable. And he said it made all the people in the meeting uncomfortable.
Brian,
basically,
Brian Clark, were you ever in any of these meetings?
No, these were meetings just of the folks who worked in the bar passage department.
Does this recording surprise you, or had you heard about the tenor of these meetings from other people?
It surprised me quite a lot. And, you know, even the deferral program, the paying people to not take the bar exam, was something that the faculty outside the bar passage folks, the faculty was not aware of. And when we first heard about it, after there was a lawsuit filed against Arizona Summit, one of the other in-law schools, about it. And that was the first any of us had heard about it. And then the only time that was addressed in a faculty meeting, we were told that it was something that had been done away with.
So
the paying people not to take the exam. I am one of the folks, as Lisa said, that, you know, this was something that it never struck me as predatory, as anything other than sort of helping people financially who need more preparation time. And, you know, I didn't, and from students I've talked to who participated in it, you know, that was their perception of it.
How does it strike you?
That's something that...
Kyle, how does it strike you?
Well, I don't think predatory is the word I would use, but what it does is signal that the choices that the in-law schools have been making for years have been irresponsible. And it might be their way out, but it also is very clearly a play to make sure that their bar passage rates don't dip too far, which would hurt them with the accreditors, with prospective students, and also with the education department.
Sitting next to you, Kyle, in a radio studio in Chapel Hill, Margaret Kojak is with you, a third-year student at the Charlotte School of Law. She's been sitting there quietly listening to all of this. Thank you for being here, Margaret. What is your reaction to hearing that tape?
I've sat in a room with Dean Alm, so I am not 100% surprised by that. She's definitely very passionate when she speaks. I really don't like when she calls people lazy. She's done so to our faces as students. That doesn't inspire greatness. So not my favorite way to coach.
You got an email from the school last year offering grant money to extend your studies and delay taking the bar. That's something we just finished talking about a little while ago. What were they offering? What was your reaction? And what was your decision? What did you decide to do?
I wasn't facing the bar at the time, so I didn't read it very closely. you know, they send a lot of emails. So I deleted it. Upon all of this coming up, I brought it back up and read it. And at first, I'm like, Brian, I agree. It looks like this great program for people who need the opportunity to take advantage of it. It's very rigorous, and I think it has the effect, the desired effect, and they pass the bar, which is great. Unfortunately, in light of the DOE letter with all the misrepresentation and fraud, I think it also, like Kyle said, definitely has the impact of changing the disclosures and manipulating statistics that students depend on and that regulators depend on. And those statistics are not there to be manipulated. They're there to show the true outcomes that the school can produce. And when you manipulate them, you manipulate my reality and my ability to make an informed decision. And I don't appreciate that.
Kyle, as Lisa said a minute ago, on the surface, this sounds like a nice attempt to make sure that students get their money's worth and that they actually leave the school having passed the bar exam so that they can pursue the career that they went to school to pursue. So it sounds like a nice thing, but you say it's unethical. Why?
Well, I'm not sure the actual act of helping these students is unethical, but it reflects the greater unethical choices that the school has been making in enrolling people and then retaining them and letting them graduate.
And you've said, Brian, that the failure of students to pass the bar on their first try was a constant issue that the faculty was raising with the administration. How was that met in 20 seconds or less by the administration? What was their reaction?
Well, that comment from me in one of Lisa's reports was actually about the admissions standard.
Okay.
And I do agree completely with Kyle on, you know, that this program was necessitated, if you will, by the admissions choices.
So, and with that, we'll take a break and be back on the other side with more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at Birkdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew, details at thescrewcrew.com. And Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools offering the CMS School Choice Lottery, now open until February 14th for kindergarten through 12th grade, striving to match dreams with schools and programs for families and students. Details at cmschoice.com. Trump.org. President Trump says he'll cut regulation by 75%, maybe more. What would deregulation mean for the economy, for workers, for the environment? It's part of On Point's 100-Day Spotlight, continuing today with a look at deregulation as well as the president's actions yesterday on two controversial pipeline projects. That's all upcoming in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, and we will continue our conversation about Charlotte School of Law in just a moment. Stay with us.
As Donald Trump shapes his new administration, a new team of leaders is coming together. And NPR will be there every step of the way to help you make sense of it all. Listen every day.
Stay in touch on air at 90.7 WFAE and online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the predicament that the Charlotte School of Law finds itself in, being under probation by the ABA, having lost student funding for student loans from the Department of Education. We invited the Charlotte School of Law to be on the program today, or somebody from the school to be on the program, but they said they would not come on because it's the subject of pending litigation, which they will address in the proper forum. We're here with Lisa Wharf, who has reported extensively on this on WFAE News, and you can hear her reports from this morning and other reports as well on our website. Kyle McEntee is the Executive Director of Law School Transparency. Margaret Kojak is a third-year law student at Charlotte School of Law. And Brian Clark is an assistant professor of business law at Western Carolina University, but he used to be at Charlotte School of Law. And at one point while you were there, you say, Brian, you gave an exam and you said that the performance was so bad that you gave more failing grades in that single section than you have ever given in every other section that you had ever taught combined. Were you alone in that result, or did you hear this from other teachers too?
No, I heard it from other teachers.
And that's emblematic of the fact that they were letting people in that didn't belong there in the first place?
Yes. And that, I mean, it's harsh to say, but, you know, not everyone has the wiring to be a lawyer. It requires some very particular ways of thinking, of writing, of the ability to express yourself, and not everybody has it. So, yeah, there were certainly, especially at that point, a lot of students in my classroom who shouldn't have been. And, you know, and I, one thing with the bar passage program, I mean, this was the constant battle that the faculty fought, is, you know, we had no control over admissions. We started, you know, we raised it constantly, as I said to Lisa, and, you know, that we needed to tighten up admissions or else there were going to be major problems. But you know, no one listened. And, you know, our job was to teach the folks in our classroom as best we could. And that's, you know, that's what we did. I think that's what, you know, Dean or Odessa Alm was trying to do with the you know, that rather harsh pep talk.
Were you encouraged as instructors to push people through the belly of the snake to the other side, to the exit door? Were you encouraged to raise grades so that they could pass on to the next class so that you could push them toward the bar exam?
We, as the faculty, were not. Okay. And we were not because of Camille Davidson, who was the Associate Dean for Academics.
Who lost her job at the end of the year, correct?
Correct. Because, you know, she supported us, the faculty, I know that she got pushback on, you know, the number of people who were receiving very poor grades because they earned those very poor grades. Mm-hmm. She received pushback from her superiors, and she refused to budge. So we never got pressured because Camille was the, you know, sort of the person standing between us and that pressure.
Lisa.
No, I mean, the school, you know, obviously realized they had a dilemma, that there were these students who were really struggling, being, you know, failed out of classes, and others who were just getting by. And, you know, at the end of the day, many of them, you know, when they graduated, weren't passing. So they did, about a year ago, make the curve tougher. And they said, this is a more accurate depiction of where these students are. And it sounds like that was probably the case. So there was certainly a move to indicate to students, you know, you're not making it,
right,
making the grade. But at the same time, oh, go ahead.
Well, and that's exactly was the motive. I mean, you know, we as faculty could not control, you know, they weren't listening to us about admissions. Hmm. And the only thing that the faculty could do to send, you know, to tell the students who were not going to be successful that they were not going to be successful was to grade them as honestly and directly as we could.
So, Kyle, you say that students enrolling at Charlotte School of Law were always weaker than students enrolling elsewhere, but it got worse once all schools began to face this demand crunch, when the employment picture in the real world began to change. When that happened, the quality of new recruits, you say, cratered. That's your word. Why? What was the Charlotte School of Law a school of last resort, or was it simply the fact that people realized there are no jobs, so why go?
Yeah, it was a school of last resort, but I do want to clarify a comment about the initial students. They were weaker than, you know, the average school, but they were still strong enough to justify their admission and their mm-hmm. retention. But then, yeah, as time went on, as the financial pressure grew, as Charlotte School of Law continued to increase their enrollment through 2012, despite the decline in applications, those students really, it was very foreseeable that they were going to struggle, and I think Charlotte knew exactly what they were doing.
And you know, back to what we were talking about, too, about, you know, for example, making the curve harder. You know, there was also adding an additional bar passage course in their third year that students were required to pass. At the same time that was going on, it seems like admissions weren't necessarily getting harder. I mean, you do in this past year see the standards go up a little bit on the LSAT scores. But there's, you know, we've heard of a program that Andrew McAdams has said that he dealt with.
He was an instructor there.
He was the instructor there, and who was one of the bar coaches. And he said, you know, his last straw was he saw, you know, all these things on the back end, you know, trying to get students ready for the bar. And on the front end, they had this alternative entry program called AMPL, which he said, hey, I thought this was a really good idea in the beginning because it's geared for students who may have lower LSAT scores, like really low LSAT scores.
This was an online course that you paid, what, $3,000 to take? Is that right?
You know, I don't think you actually did pay.
Okay.
You know, I've seen different things, but I think it wasn't necessarily that. It may have been free. So,
okay.
It's a paid program.
Some, you know, in some places it is a paid program. Is it Margaret, are you saying it was a paid program at Charlotte School of Law?
It is at Charlotte School of Law. It's paid for. And I know that not all people that entered it actually were lower indicators. Sometimes they forced higher level people into it as well. I'm not sure why.
But anyway, some of the
revenue generator,
some of the scores that were coming through here, he graded the final exam. That was his only part of it. And he said these were low, low, low scores.
Okay.
And he said, you know, at this point, that was his last straw.
Let me spend some time with Margaret. She's been sitting here most of the show listening to it. She's a student, third year student there. And you face a difficult situation because I don't know whether you have a student loan or not, but if you do, you're not getting any money for it. And I think you have 10 credit hours left. It puts you in a particularly difficult position because you're not even sure whether the school will be operating for the time it takes you to get through those 10 credits. And you're also, are you at all concerned about if you get out that your diploma will be worthless?
So I have 13 credit hours left,
okay.
Still one semester.
Okay.
I'm a different student. I am non-traditional in that I'm 37. I own my own business. I live in Charlotte. I'm from Charlotte. So I'm not as worried that my degree won't be as, you know, won't be worth anything because I'm lucky to have, you know, my own business. And this was to support that. In addition, as a part-time evening student, for all of my part-time evening students, we're beholden to the school. We all live in Charlotte. We have jobs in Charlotte. We have families that moved to Charlotte. I mean, we can't leave. And yes, I do get federal aid. And yes, I am terrified. I have repeatedly asked for clarification in the letters that they send out that say, we'll credit your account pending DOE reinstatement of funds. Well, I don't know what that means. If DOE doesn't reinstate the funds, what does that mean to me?
And you've asked and they won't tell you?
We get told it'll be 24 to 48 hours. You may get institutional loans. InfoLaw may be willing to give some money. By give, I mean sign a loan. I've been told some pretty interesting things in a meeting that I had with Chitty and Jay. I was told
Chitty
when I asked
the,
about...
Chitty is the president of the school, correct?
Yes, he's
okay.
Still there.
All right.
Yeah. So when I was at, when I asked about the loans, when they first brought it up, I wanted clarification. What are they dischargeable at bankruptcy? What's the interest rate? You know, these kinds of things are imperative when you're making a large financial decision because mm-hmm. the tuition is so high. And I was told, oh, well, we have to vet the students and we have to really, you know, really look into will they be able to get employment and pay them back because these are third party loans and they are just dischargeable during bankruptcy.
So the average cost of getting out of law school, out of this law school, I believe, is $133,000. Is that right?
I'd say that's a safe bet. It's significantly higher, though.
Okay.
The tuition alone, but when they allow you to take grad plus loans, so you're looking at 160 to 200.
Why did you choose Charlotte School of Law in the first place? Was it because of its reputation? Was it because you have a business and you had to go to night classes? Why?
It definitely wasn't because of the reputation, sadly. It's because I had a job and I lived in Charlotte and it had a part-time evening program. I believe it's one of two in the state of North Carolina that offers that.
And
how
the only
the other.
Two law schools that have a, yeah, there's only two part-time evening programs in
okay.
North Carolina. There's none in South Carolina.
And how
so a lot
right.
of people come for that.
And how would you right. assess the education you've gotten so far, if you can assess it?
Well, I haven't been to another law school, so I can't really speak to that. Although I have enjoyed my classes, and I think they are, you know, top-notch. I believe that the professors there are well-prepared. They know what they're talking about. They have experience in the law. They teach it in the same manner that I think any other one, you know, any other law school would teach it. Unfortunately, the caliber of student might bring down some of our lecture.
Well I was going to ask what changes, if any, you have perceived over the time that you've been there as Charlotte School of Law struggled with declining enrollment and the need to improve performance, et cetera.
My first year, there were a lot of people who raised their hands and asked questions that were clearly answered in the reading. So it clearly indicated that they had not prepared for class. I was, you know, first year, some of the writing, the professors said, oh, don't write in bullet points, which is astonishing to me that anyone would do that. But so those kinds of things occurred. And then when they changed the curve, a lot more people were not showing up to class because they were not asked back. So, you know, then those questions end up sort of dissipating and you can get on to the business of learning.
I know that you wanted to talk about this Fresh Start program. What is that?
I am not 100% on this, but per my understanding, when they changed the curve to, I think it's a C or C minus curve, more people failed out than was first expected. And so they asked 20 students to come back, and those 20 students came after their first year, who had failed out, came back and started again as 1Ls. And of those 20, 18 failed out again.
And you've talked to the Observer about being exhausted about this because you say it's exhausting being this mad for this long and finding things out after the fact and not being told anything, which you've already referred to in this conversation. Mm-hmm. Some students are planning to sue the school. Are you among them?
I'm not a named plaintiff, although if the class is certified, then I will by default be there. I could opt out if I'd like, but my goal is to graduate in May and sit for the bar in July and put this all behind me. Being part of a lawsuit right now isn't my goal.
Okay. Given the news of what's been happening at Charlotte School of Law, from admitting unqualified students to the low bar passage rates, when a student does graduate and does pass the bar, I'd like to hear from Kyle and Brian about this. When this happens, are they looked at by law firms on an equal footing with others from other schools, or does this automatically put a cloud over their heads, the fact that the degree comes from Charlotte School of Law, even though they passed the bar? In other words, if you pass the bar, you pass the bar. Does the school matter?
It does. Yeah, the legal profession is obsessed with prestige, and prestige is very, 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 very difficult to change at all, let alone in the 14 years that or 13 years that this school has been in existence.
Brian?
Yeah, it matters a lot, I 100% agree with Kyle. I mean, this is a prestige-obsessed profession, and the quality of the education, the quality of the student, you know, they've got to even get through the door. And a lot, I mean, certainly larger law firms, more, you know, fancier law firms won't even let a lot of Charlotte Law grads even through the door.
The school claims it is not going to close despite its troubles, although they may shift to a nonprofit status. What difference would that make?
It wouldn't make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that if Charlotte School of Law remains as it is, I don't think it would make any difference.
Okay.
You know, I think that a public, affordable law school located in Charlotte, you know, operated by the UNC system, that's small and high quality and affordable and very affordable, could be
also
great
affordable
for the city. but it must be affordable.
I have 20 seconds left. All three of the schools that InfoLaw operates, the one in Charlotte, the one in Florida, the one in Arizona, they're all in trouble with the ABA or the Department of Education. And there's also another for-profit law school in Charleston that is also in trouble. Is this something that's a problem because it's for profit, or is it something because of what InfoLaw does? Kyle, quickly.
Sure. This is an indication of the law that Congress passed that allows the Department of Education to only deal with for-profit and vocational schools. If nonprofit schools were, you know, equipped to the same standards, there'd be trouble there, too.
Kyle McEntee is Executive Director of Law School Transparency. Brian Clark, a former professor there, now at Western Carolina University. Margaret Kojak, a third-year student at Charlotte School of Law. And good luck to you, Margaret. And Lisa Wharf with WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.